It is inevitable, after Thursday's vote, that Britain's economy is going to have to adjust to the new situation we find ourselves in. However, it is already evident that as a result of Thursday's decision, some firms are continuing to pause their decisions to invest or to hire people. And to companies large and small, I would say this: the British economy is fundamentally strong, we are highly competitive, and we are open for business.
This week on Vox Talks, as the Brexit process grinds on, where are firms investing? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Now, that clip at the beginning of this week's episode was George Osborne. When Brexit happened, he was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and that's a speech he gave immediately following the Brexit vote. But have his hopes that firms large and small will continue to find a UK an attractive place to invest been borne out? Or are these firms switching investments to the other 27 nations of the EU? Well, with me today are two economists who've been following this story since that speech. The investment numbers are in, and Holger Breinlich of the University of Surrey and Dennis Novy of the University of Warwick, who are both CEPR research fellows, are going to tell us what the data is telling us. So, Holger, welcome to Vox Talks.
Hi, Tim.
And Dennis, welcome back.
Hi, Tim.
Dennis, if you live in the UK, every week on the news, there's a reporter in a hard hat visiting a factory, and she's telling us that investment's being moved abroad or coming here or staying here. And it's really confusing. It's impossible to work out what's going on. Is what you're doing here trying to measure that overall effect?
That's right. We're trying to bring some clarity. It's difficult to see this just from day to day because, as you say, there's always firms coming in and some British firms investing elsewhere outside of the UK. And what we're trying to do here is measure foreign direct investment, FDI, in a systematic way. And it's quite important for the UK. I mean, for obvious reasons, Brexit, FDI has come up a lot in the media. People want to know whether there will be strong investment in the UK economy after Brexit. Why does that matter? Well, FDI is really important for productivity. If you invest, then you get higher productivity, and that should translate into higher wages, higher profits. So it's really what you want as a country. And traditionally, the UK has done really well on foreign direct investment. The UK has attracted quite a lot of investment from all sorts of countries in the world, EU and non-EU, actually much more, disproportionately much, than other countries, say France or Germany in comparison. So it's an obvious question you want to ask. Is the UK still going strong, and will it be able to hold up its really strong traditional position?
Looking at the paper you've written about this, it's two questions really, isn't it? Because you've got one flow of investment that's going from British firms either into the UK or into the EU27. And then there's also that flow of investment from the EU27 back to the UK. What does each one of these flows tell us about the economy?
So, I mean, we are interested in both flows because, I mean, if you look at, say, UK-EU flows first, one of the things that's been covered a lot in the media is that British firms after Brexit, after the referendum, they're now worried about access to the European market. We don't know whether there will be tariff barriers, other barriers. So one thing you might want to do as a company is set up shop in the EU27, basically, to keep access after Brexit. For banks, that's very important to continue to serve clients, but maybe also for manufacturing firms and other firms. So that's one direction. But you might also think the same might be true for European firms. So they obviously, they face the same dilemma. Maybe after Brexit, for them, it will be harder to serve their British clients. But there's also this other argument that you might want to make, that after Brexit, the UK becomes a less attractive place for several reasons. For example, it might be that if you have complex supply chains and need to ship stuff to the UK, that becomes more difficult. So maybe why not keep the entire supply chain in the European Union, for example? And maybe growth will be less strong after Brexit. So maybe there's less of an incentive to invest in the UK. Maybe you rather want to invest somewhere else. So I think it's these two things. So we don't know which of these two factors will be stronger. And basically, that's what our research is about.
I see. So you're looking at how these two forces balance out. But how big are these flows in pounds and euros?
So what we do is basically we look at counts of transactions. So the way to think about this is we look at both greenfield FDI. So that's when a foreign company sets up a new factory or extends an existing factory in the UK, or a UK firm sets up a factory in the EU. So that's one thing that's called greenfield FDI. Then there are also mergers and acquisitions where you buy an existing firm. So a UK firm might buy an existing company in the EU to keep access to the EU market. So that's mergers and acquisitions. And we're looking at both of these. We're basically just counting these transactions every quarter. And in our data, we have around 600 transactions per year. And that's something around an order of magnitude of £40 billion per year. So I think it's important to keep in mind that measuring FDI is notoriously difficult. So we're using a particular set of data that focuses on transaction counts. There are other ways. The Office for National Statistics has another way of measuring things. But their data usually come out with a long delay. So we can't really use them for what we're interested in here, which is get an up-to-date picture of what's going on. Our analysis goes up to and including the first quarter of 2019, so including the run-up to the initial Brexit date where companies got really worried about will there be a no deal or not, and that's clearly something we'll see in the data.
You've been measuring this over several years now in this Brexit process that seems to go on as long as anyone can remember. Economies change over that time, so how do you know that what you're measuring here is the result of Brexit?
Right, that's a really good question. It's a very important question. We use what sometimes people call the doppelganger method.
Oh.
You know, these old gangster movies where you have a lookalike, right? This is exactly what we do. We're constructing a UK lookalike. So what that means is, say we want to look at foreign direct investment from the UK to the EU. What we do is we control a group of countries that also do the same thing prior to Brexit. That's our doppelganger, and it's supposed to look exactly the same. That's our lookalike. And then we look all the way back up to Brexit. Our data actually start in 2010. So we look from 2010 till the mid of 2016 when Brexit happened. And by construction, our doppelganger and the UK behave in pretty much exactly the same way up until that point. And then we say, okay, Brexit was the surprise, at least to most people and to most businesses. Financial markets didn't expect this to happen, the referendum in June 2016. And then we look at how these two groups, the UK as it really is, and the doppelganger, how they diverge, if at all, after 2016. So we could find that after the referendum, there's no difference. The doppelganger still is a lookalike and nothing happens. But that's not what we do find. We find actually that the doppelganger is no longer quite a doppelganger after 2016. There is a divergence. And then we attribute that divergence to Brexit. And it's very geeky, but Tim, you say your listeners like geeky things. So there you go. It's a synthetic control method. It's quite popular in economics.
Okay, we've kept everyone in suspense then. How big is this divergence? First of all, looking at British firms investing in Europe, what's the trend here?
We have found that investment of British firms into the other EU 27 member states has increased. And to be precise, it's increased by 17%.
17, that's quite a lot.
17. It is quite a lot. What this tells you is that British firms are presumably thinking about Brexit and the increasing trade frictions and investment frictions this might bring about. And in order to avoid the frictions, they say, let's set up a subsidiary or some business in the EU 27 so that we can operate from within the EU 27 even after Brexit, and therefore still have market access as we currently do as a UK firm being an EU member. That has led to an increase of 17% more investment into the European Union.
I see. And anecdotally, that's where you see those stories about people moving particular functions to mainland Europe.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
So what kind of firms are making that investment?
We have manufacturing firms in our data set, and we have services firms. So services are financial services, things like legal services, transportation companies. That's actually the majority of the economy. Manufacturing would be car firms, it would be machinery production firms, and so on. We find that this entire increase of more foreign direct investment into the EU is driven by services firms. So it's just services firms that do it. Now, why is it services firm? We don't know for sure, but there are, in principle, two possibilities. The first thing is that for a services firm, it's actually relatively easy. You know, if you're a services firm, you essentially just need some office space, you need people, but you don't need a huge investment in some physical factory. That would be the case for a manufacturing firm. Think about a car firm. You'd have to set up a car plant or perhaps buy an existing car plant. That would be really involved. For a services firm, it's quite interesting. You can essentially set up a letterbox firm, which is quite easy to do. Now, that's one reason it's easy. The second reason is that potentially for services, this is where companies feel the biggest frictions might arise. Of course, we don't know quite yet how Brexit will play out, but it might be very likely that if Britain leaves the European Union, they will leave the single market. And the single market is really important for services. It's about regulation, passporting rights, and banking. I think that's one area that's been quite prominent in the public debate. And if you think that the single market is no longer at your fingertips in the UK, then possibly that's why you want to act, and that's more important for services firms.
All the news we're getting at the moment is that we are much more likely to head for no deal, that we're even planning strategically for no deal now. Does that mean that this trend of UK firms, Holger, investing in Europe is going to speed up?
I think that's likely to happen. Our data go up to and including the first quarter of 2019. And so that obviously, that was the initial Brexit date. And you can see in the data that things seem to be speeding up as we approach January, February, March 2019. This gap between actual flows from the UK into the EU and our doppelganger, that gap seems to be widening. Now, heading towards October, it stands to reason that the same thing will happen again. So firms now really get nervous and they think now we really have to set up an affiliate in the EU to get ready. So that's, I think that's what we're expecting.
Now, there's another bunch of firms that will be getting quite nervous, you might imagine, which would be firms based in Europe who want to retain access to the UK market. And as you said, there is potentially a flow of investment that might either go up or go down. So what's the result?
You're absolutely right, Tim. It's a principle two-way street, right? I mean, you put up a barrier in the middle and it's more difficult for either side to access the other, right? So you might think, okay, if UK firms invest more in the EU, EU firms should do exactly the same thing in Britain. Mm. But that's not what we see.
Oh.
We do not see more investment from EU firms in Britain. In fact, we actually see a small decline to the tune of 9%. So it was plus 17% from the UK to the EU 27 and minus 9% in the opposite direction. So there's an asymmetry. Why is there the asymmetry? We don't know for sure. You'd have to ask firms directly and ask the managers why they're doing it or why they're not doing it. But the obvious potential reason here is that the UK is small, the rest of the EU 27 is very large. So if you lose access to a very, very large market, then of course you have a strong incentive to invest. But if you lose access to a relatively smaller market, an EU 27 firm losing access to the UK, that is, well, you might want to invest potentially at some point, but possibly if you're an EU 27 firm, probably want to wait and see a little bit until the uncertainty has subsided. And if anything, you would invest afterwards.
There is also that the pound is losing value against the euro and other European currencies. Is that going to make a difference to this trend?
So you might think, yes, it should make a difference. Clearly, if the pound goes down, it gets cheaper to buy companies in the UK. So you would expect that European firms are buying more British firms. So we think that probably will help to sustain investment in the UK. Having said that, the same thing obviously happened after the referendum, and we had this close to 10% depreciation of the pound after the referendum. And that apparently didn't stop our results from happening. So it's still the case that British firms are investing in Europe, but not the other way around. So it stands to reason that probably what would have happened without the depreciation, our results would be even stronger. So I think what would have happened most likely is that we would have seen European firms investing even less in the UK without the depreciation. So it's partially offset it, but it wasn't enough to make a difference to overturn our results.
We started off with George Osborne talking straight after the referendum. And around that time, the big news was that there might be some terrible financial collapse if we voted for Brexit. And that was made fun of by the politicians who were looking at Brexit. They called it Project Fear. One of those people that was making fun of it, I note, is now Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Do your results seem to imply that the people who were warning about Project Fear were right?
Yes. If you think that Brexit wouldn't do anything to the British economy, all would be well, then you're mistaken. Now, it is true, therefore, that Project Fear, in the sense that we think something bad might happen to the economy, turned out to be Project Reality. The issue, though, is in the public debate is that these stories that we're talking about here and that are driven by the data, they're not bombastic in the sense that there's a huge crisis all over the news from one day to the other. These are things that are in the data. You have to look for it. And firms usually don't make a gigantic noise when they're doing this. They don't want to be at the center of public attention. So you have to look hard in the data. And the average person in the street, of course, doesn't do that. The average person in the street doesn't consume the research, perhaps unlike some of your listeners, Tim. But if you look carefully, you do see some damage to the British economy, but it's not apparent and it's not splashed in the Daily Mail. And I think that's why politically all these research results may not convince that many people of an opinion that they haven't held already.
So I think one of the problems was also that the Treasury put out this report of what might happen, what they called the shock scenario. And I think most people are focused on that. So GDP would go down by 6%, unemployment would skyrocket, house prices would halve, that sort of scenario. Whereas if you look at what other forecasters have forecast, it's much more reasonable and seems to be in line with what has actually happened after Brexit. So for example, GDP falling relative to trend, inflation going up, so all these things have happened, but people tend to focus on this shock scenario, which has kind of distracted from the real economic effect that Brexit is already having on the UK economy.
So it's not so much that the sky is falling, it's that the sky might get a little bit lower
it's sinking at a slow speed. Yes. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, we do this sort of academic research. We have produced some of these reports. And of course, we would say that what we have done is great. But to be honest, the serious academic research has gotten it right. I mean, some of the details are off. I mean, this is the nature of forecasts, right? You don't get it 100% right all the time. To give you one example, people thought that right after the referendum, consumption would go down or would suffer quite rapidly. That did happen, but not immediately. It only happened about half a year afterwards, because only then did prices really jump up and people started spending a little bit less. So things didn't quite turn out exactly the way. The timing was a little off. But overall, now after some 2 or 3 years, the forecasts of the serious academics look actually quite reasonable. I mean, of course, the problem for the general public is how do they distinguish a forecast from what I call a serious academic, graciously
You're pointing at yourself yes, as a serious
and
academic.
And somebody who is just doing a political hatchet job or who's paid to say something, whether it's true or not, right? And that's the big problem that economists face, because what we say ultimately is political. If a biologist speaks about some infectious disease, that's not necessarily political, but of course, economists
on Brexit.
Maybe one last important point is I think there's always a misunderstanding. So what economists usually say is that this is the effect is compared to what would have happened without the referendum. So nobody said in these forecasts that the UK economy would contract by 2%. What economists said that the UK economy would be 2% larger if the referendum had gone the other way. But that's kind of a very subtle point that always gets lost. If you then look at the data and see, I mean, there was no recession. Does that mean that the forecasts were wrong? No, it does not mean that. But I think that's an important point to get across. And that's also in this research and other research, something that you always need to look out for. So what would have happened otherwise, and do a good job constructing what we call a counterfactual would be.
Now, one of the other political points that was made is that Britain can now throw off the shackles of the European Union and start looking outwards, a global Britain. You're looking at FDI trends. Is there any evidence that we are grasping the opportunity of global Britain?
No, there isn't. We do not find an increase in FDI flows from Britain to countries outside of the European Union. Places like Mexico or Brazil or India, the FDI patterns coming from Britain are no different than they would have been otherwise. So we don't see a global Britain effect. But in any case, I mean, if you think about doing this as a firm, the story about global Britain would be, well, throwing off the shackles of the EU and ultimately lowering frictions with those other countries. I just mentioned Mexico as one example. Right now, Britain has a free trade agreement and an investment agreement with Mexico. And why does Britain have it? Because it's a member of the EU and the EU has this agreement. If Britain now leaves the European Union, it loses that trade agreement unless it's rolled over. Global Britain shouldn't be expected because, at least initially, unless we quickly replicate those trade deals, trade barriers will go up, which should make it harder to do deals with other countries. Of course, that's not then true just for the other countries, also true for the EU.
Could it be that at the beginning of November, when we know exactly on what terms we have left the European Union, that all the investment trends return back to where they were before, the pendulum swings back, and this seemed like a lot of worrying about not very much?
So I think, I mean, that's a really interesting question. So I think the way I think about this is that there are these two effects, really, as you're saying. So there's this uncertainty about what will happen, and then the stuff that will actually happen. So it really depends on what will happen in October, I think. So if we really crash out, that's kind of the worst case scenario what everyone thought about. So I think it's a misunderstanding to think it's just uncertainty. So it's uncertainty because people are worried about the worst case scenario. But if the worst case then is actually realized, then we shouldn't expect investment to return to normal. I think quite the opposite will happen. I think as we found in the run-up to March 2019, probably outflows will accelerate. Having said that, if for some reason there is the UK and the EU manage to find a compromise, and we have a transition period, and maybe with the prospect of having a good trade deal at the end of those 2 years, then it stands to reason that indeed it could be that now firms have been holding off on investment because they were worried about this. But now things are looking much better than what everyone expected, and then investment will resume. And we might again see that the UK becomes a very attractive place for European firms to invest. But as I said, it all depends on what the deal or no deal will be in the end.
I think the general point also is that things will not be over by October 31st. It doesn't matter almost whether we will leave with a deal or without a deal or whether we won't leave at all, in the sense that uncertainty will persist. Because imagine we leave without a deal. Well, we will very quickly be back at the negotiating table with the European Union to clean up the mess. And I'm not trying to blame anyone here. I'm not saying it's the fault of the UK or the rest of you. Whatever your view is, the uncertainty, the negotiations will go on. They will go on for years. And if you're thinking about this as a business, it's just not very nice to invest because businesses don't like uncertainty. Even if we remain, right? I mean, what would happen politically in the UK? It doesn't mean that suddenly all the people who voted leave will say, okay, fine, yeah, we're not leaving. Let's move on. Of course not. The political uncertainty will persist, and that's just not good for investment.
Dennis Holger, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dennis thinks that you're all looking for the geeky detail about this from the research, so I better tell you where that is. All of this research and more is in a CEPR discussion paper, and that's called Voting With Their Money, Brexit and Outward Investment by UK Firms. That's number 13850. Authors are Holger, Elsa Leroman, Dennis and Thomas Sampson. And there's a Vox EU column of the same name, and that was from earlier in the year, February, I think. Same subject, same title, but with it being February, the data's not so up to date. But it does set out the arguments that we've been talking about here, if you're interested in that. If you are interested in arguing about Brexit using data rather than what you saw in the news last night, Vox EU has loads of other columns from all four of these authors, and also from their colleagues at the LSE Centre for Economic Performance, which is a fountain of information on the economic events of Brexit.
Next week on Vox Talks, could raising the federal minimum wage cut deaths of despair?
We find that a 10% increase in the minimum wage would reduce suicides by about 800 to 1,000 suicides per year.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Check out our episodes every Friday by subscribing on your podcast platform. Or find us at voxeu.org/vox-talks.